The views expressed in this program are those of the participants.
Tell me, Mrs. Hartman, do you know the Lombardis?
That certainly was a terrible tragedy, those murders.
They certainly were.
Were what?
A terrible tragedy.
Oh, yeah, terrible. Oh, and senseless, too. I mean, you know, murder with no reason or no motive. I mean, really senseless when you think about it.
Of course, there could be any number of psychological reasons why.
See, I've always been very interested in psychology. See, I sent away for a book on psychology once. It was guaranteed to improve your emotional health. I thought it was a wonderful book. Maybe you read it.
What was the name of it?
Oh, I don't remember. But it was a wonderful book.
No, I didn't read it.
No? Oh. Well, it was guaranteed to improve my emotional health.
Did it improve your emotional health?
I think so. I definitely think so. You see, it was while I was reading that book that I realized that I needed glasses, and that made me feel much better.
Well, that's more than most people can say.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome, everyone. It is Saturday, January 13th, 2024. I'm Bob Metz, and this is Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. Join us for an hour of discussion that's not right-wing, it's just right.
Fade into color, and color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
There is a meme going around that reads, quote, "When you're dead, you don't know you're dead. The pain is felt by others. The same thing happens when you're stupid," end quote. And wow, I thought that was kind of profound, you know, if you stop to think about it. Because if you were to finish that thought, it would read, "When you're stupid, you don't know you're stupid. The pain is felt by others." Which presents a challenge. How can those of us in pain protect ourselves from the stupidity of others? Now, I recall many years ago having reviewed what might be called a hierarchy of intelligence. And let me tell you, being stupid was right at the bottom of that list. Like, I can't get more blunt about it. You can't get stupider than being stupid. A quick review on the internet reminded me that, quote, the terms idiot, imbecile, and moron were, not so long ago, used in a psychological classification system, and each one was assigned to a fairly specific range of abilities. For example, idiots were those so defective that the mental development never exceeds that of a normal child of about 2 years. Imbeciles are those whose development is higher than that of an idiot, but whose intelligence does not exceed that of a normal child of about 7 years. Morons are those whose mental development is above that of an imbecile, but does not exceed that of a normal child of about 12 years, end quote. But stupid was the closest state to being unconscious, quote, to the point of stupor, characterized by or in a state of stupor, paralyzed, lacking sensation, inanimate, destitute of consciousness, insensate, end quote. And then, of course, there's Isabel Patterson's definition of the word fool in connection with her appraisal of Karl Marx, quote, "Marx was a fool with a large vocabulary of long words, for the deficiency which is indicated by the word fool is the incapacity to understand categories and the relation of things and qualities. Misuse of language is the means by which the Marxist cult of communism has done the most serious injury to intelligence," end quote. Well, if there's one thing any conscious and intelligent person has realized over the past few years, it's that stupid people can be dangerous people. Not just to others, but to themselves as well. But, you know, they've got the advantage of being too stupid to know they're hurting themselves, and therefore have no incentive to stop their own pain. Stupidity lies at the heart of all political and philosophical conflicts, particularly within the political polarity of left and right. Stupidity is a fundamental characteristic of all leftist thinking, and I'm not saying that as someone on the right out to insult my ideological opponents, because as I've illustrated many times on our show before, all of us are born stupid, and this is a natural human condition. The younger a person is. I mean, the younger you are, the less you know. Problem is, too many people live their whole lives out and end up dying in a state of stupidity, never having escaped the prison of their own mindlessness. Quote, no one really knows who first coined the saying, if you're not a socialist at 20, you have no heart, and if you're not a conservative at 40, you have no brain. It wasn't Prime Minister Winston Churchill or Oscar Wilde, although it's often attributed to them. The smart money seems to be on a rather obscure French jurist from the 19th century, Anselm Batby. Whatever the source, it's been repeated for well over a century because it seems to ring true, end quote. Well, it's understandable that one might come to conclude that stupidity is a flaw in the nature of humanity. But you know, I've come to a realization that that is not so. In fact, it's a major piece of evidence that free will exists, and that the ability to escape our stupidity is the real marvel and uniqueness of the human race. So, let's stop fooling ourselves about stupidity, shall we? And we can start right after our reminder that you can write us at feedback@justrightmedia.org. Hear us on WBCQ, Channel 292, and WTWW Shortwave. Follow and like us on your favorite podcast platform, and visit us at justrightmedia.org, where you can access all of our social media links, archive broadcasts, and the support button that makes it easy for you to support the show. Because, as always, your financial support is appreciated and is what makes this show possible. Now, when I said that we're all born stupid, I meant this in the context of a principle or concept, if you will, known as tabula rasa, loosely translated as a blank slate. And I quote Ayn Rand on the subject, quote, since man has no automatic knowledge, he can have no automatic values. Since he has no innate ideas, he can have no innate value judgments. Man is born with an emotional mechanism, just as he's born with a cognitive mechanism. But at birth, both are tabula rasa. It is man's cognitive faculty, his mind, that determines the content of both. At birth, a child's mind is tabula rasa. He has the potential of awareness, the mechanism of a human consciousness, but no content. Speaking metaphorically, he has a camera with an extremely sensitive unexposed film, his conscious mind, and an extremely complex computer waiting to be programmed, his subconscious. Both are blank. He knows nothing of the external world. He faces an immense chaos, which he must learn to perceive by means of the complex mechanism which he must learn to operate. If in any 2 years of adult life, men could learn as much as an infant learns in his first 2 years, they would have the capacity of genius. To focus his eyes, which is not an innate but an acquired skill, to perceive the things around him by integrating his sensations into precepts, which is not an innate but an acquired skill, to coordinate his muscles for the task of crawling, then standing upright, then walking, and ultimately to grasp the process of concept formation and to learn to speak. These are some of an infant's tasks and achievements whose magnitude is not equaled by most men in the rest of their lives. And then she adds, no one is born with any kind of talent, and therefore every skill has to be acquired. Writers are made, not born. To be exact, writers are self-made, end quote. Now, I recall when I raised the concept of tabula rasa at a school board meeting in London, Ontario, many decades ago, and the hostile response I got from some of the board members there really took me by surprise. Oh no, Mr. Metz, children are not born into this world in a state of tabula rasa. I was actually surprised that anyone on the school board would even be aware of the concept, let alone being able to reject it. But upon discovering that not only were they aware of the concept, that they rejected it, I had to conclude that either these folks were completely misinformed as to the meaning of the term tabula rasa, or that they had some other agenda in mind, not quite consistent with providing an education to our school children. And if there's one thing that both Robert Vaughn and I understood to the core about the so-called public education system, it is that it has produced generation after generation of stupider and stupider people to a point where even graduates of the system are able to graduate without being able to read or write. In other words, while some people might just be born stupid, many stupid people are self-made or were made so by others. Which brings us to our first two audio bites on the theme of stupidity. On this side of our upcoming bumper, we hear from Trent Fowler in conversation with Peter St. Ange on America's stupid Congress, stupid elite, and stupid democracy, as heard on the November 21st, 23 Futurati podcast. While on the return side of the bumper, James Woods on December 26, 23 brings our attention to Bonhoeffer's theory of stupidity, which should give us all pause to take some time to understand the nature of stupidity and its incredible dangers.
Tonight we're joined by Peter St. Ange. Peter is a PhD economist at the Heritage Foundation, a Mises Institute fellow, and a former MBA professor in Taiwan. He's a fan of the Austrian School of Economics, which build the field on solid foundations. And what drives him is understanding how to make the world more prosperous using smart policy and technological advancements. Peter, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Of course. Thanks for having me on.
Let's hear a little bit about your background, your interests, and what brought you to working on the stuff that you're working on today.
So I am an economist at the Heritage Foundation. I'm also a fellow at the Mises Institute. I'm a former professor in Taiwan, where you don't have to put up with the political whatnot. And before that, I worked in corporate marketing in telecoms and then in one of the biggest toy companies in Japan, Takara. They make the Transformers robots in disguise. And nowadays, I'm best known for shooting random videos every day.
Well, fantastic. Why did you choose economics?
I've always loved economics. It is sort of, you know that scene in The Matrix where he finally has his epiphany and he looks around and it's no longer a door, it's no longer a hallway, now it's just pure code, right? And for an economist, that's the appeal, right? Is that all of these things around you, you can sort of see the underlying code. Like, why are people doing that? Why aren't they not doing the other thing? Why are they miserable? Why are they happy? What are their goals? What do they think they're trying to achieve? And, you know, of course, governments misuse economics because they want to use that code to try to influence people. And so a lot of what I do talk about is complaining about the government, but I would dearly love to never, ever talk about the government in a way for it to just fade out to irrelevancy, because it really is very stupid. Like, you know, I've spent a couple of years in the political world now, and I mean, you would be amazed how stupid Congress is. It is really, really striking. I'm not just picking on them, like literally. If I go to like a state legislature where, you know, they're part-timers, they run at a used car dealership or something, those are normal humans. Okay, you can talk to them like a real human, like an adult. Congress people, oh my goodness, they're really, really stupid.
I figure I'm just going to ask an economist, you know, while I have you here, if you have any thoughts about the decline in the quality of the elites, right? So I'm listening to Congress.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So somebody like Mark Zuckerberg, and I mean, you know, we all use technology all the time whose internal workings we don't understand that well. But it is clear that these people are just nowhere in the ballpark. They don't vaguely understand what's going on, and they propose to legislate it. But yeah, I mean, you can read Benjamin Franklin's writings. You can read Winston Churchill's writings. You know, he's famous for having written a 5-volume history of the English-speaking peoples. And I can't imagine many people in Congress could get through 5 volumes of history on anything at all. And I just don't know where we went wrong along the way, if that's just sort of part of the dynamics of democracy and these people have to engineer consent day by day. I really don't know, but it has been a noticeable decline in the quality of the elites, especially in the States.
Yeah, I think there's two parts of it. One of them, the elite itself, I think, is worse than normal because it is particularly corrupt. And I think that's tied to the second reason, which is the decline of the education system. And it's funny because if you talk to the average person, like the average educated person, they're under the impression that the spread of public education, the fact that everybody can get a government education, they think that that has improved the electorate. That is comical. We are so stupid, it hurts. So my kids homeschool, you will hear this from any homeschooler, right? They will talk about how their kids are doing like particle physics at 7 years old. This is not because homeschool is magical, right? Like most homeschoolers, they do it for religious reasons. They're not particularly educated, right? So how do their kids come out as, you know, just these amazing geniuses? I mean, it's possible that the kids are just all, you know, born geniuses. What I think is really happening is that the school system is so bad, we have no idea how it crushes children, makes them stupid, makes them into stupid adults, who then become stupid elites. Now, if you combine that in stupidization of our culture, and you combine that with an elite that is corrupt, so they're not even chosen based on merit or based on intelligence, they're chosen... I mean, essentially, can they dance to the ideological tune that's currently in vogue? You put those two together, and yes, we have an amazingly stupid elite compared to what we've had in the past. There's a great book by Hans Hermann Hoppe called Democracy, the God That Failed, and he contrasts what happens in an aristocratic or a monarchical society where the natural elite tends to be amplified and promoted and given social prestige. Now, I think that we delayed that, even though America was democratic, I think that we delayed that, the sort of fall from that state, the fall from this natural hierarchy to this sort of fiat hierarchy. I think we delayed it because we had a very limited constitution. So we had a very, very small government. There were only a few things that the government was allowed to do. There's like eight things listed in the constitution, and it's not allowed to do anything else. Of course, the Supreme Court, over time has not noticed the 10th Amendment that forbids all the rest of it. But anyway, I think that that's why the U.S. lasted a lot longer than you would expect for a democracy. I think that's why in 1900 we still had smart people. And then I think the rest of the world pulled the wrong lesson from the U.S. So Europe, for example, looked at the U.S. and they said, well, look, the U.S. is powerful. They were looking in 1914 when Europe, or 1918 when Europe became democratic. They were looking at the U.S. They said, well, you know, the U.S. is democratic. And it's not a complete disaster. So I guess we could be, too. I think they pulled the complete wrong lessons, which is that what was protecting the U.S. was that the Constitution kept the government so small that we could still have that natural aristocracy sort of determining social mores. So, for example, you know, the poor knew that if you wanted to become unpoor, you had to work hard and you had to stay away from the demon rum. And, you know, it was sort of this commonsensical stuff, as opposed to accepting yourself just the way you are and all the rubbish that they plug in their heads today that lead to generational poverty. And so, of course, Europe went democratic and, you know, we meanwhile became more totalitarian in our democracy. And so now I think what we're seeing is the sort of stereotypical democracy through history where it gets very, very stupid and very, very cruel. It does things like, say, force people to take experimental therapies that could kill them. I won't describe it more than that. Because I don't
know. We won't be able to put it on YouTube. Yeah, we won't be able to put it
yes,
on YouTube.
Yes, there you go. So we'll just leave it at that.
In the darkest chapter of German history, during a time when incited mobs threw stones into the windows of innocent shop owners and women and children were cruelly humiliated in the open, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a young pastor, began to speak publicly against the atrocities that the regime had produced. After years of trying to change people's minds, Dietrich Bonhoeffer came home one evening and his own father had to tell him that two men were waiting in his room to take him away. In prison, Bonhoeffer began to reflect on how his country of poets and thinkers had turned into a collective of cowards, crooks, and criminals. Eventually, he concluded that the root of the problem was not malice, but stupidity. In his famous Letters from Prison, Bonhoeffer argued that stupidity is a more dangerous enemy of the good than malice, because while one may protest against evil, it can be exposed and prevented by the use of force. Against stupidity, we are defenseless. Neither protests nor the use of force accomplish anything here. Reasons fall on deaf ears. facts that contradict a stupid person's prejudgment simply need not be believed, and when they are irrefutable, they are just pushed aside as inconsequential, as incidental. In all this, the stupid person is self-satisfied and, being easily irritated, becomes dangerous by going on the attack. For that reason, greater caution is called for when dealing with a stupid person than with a malicious one. If we want to know how to get the better of stupidity, we must seek to understand its nature. This much is certain. Stupidity is, in essence, not an intellectual defect, but a moral one. There are human beings who are remarkably agile intellectually, yet stupid, and others who are intellectually dull, yet anything but stupid. The impression one gains is not so much that stupidity is a congenital defect, but that, under certain circumstances, people are made stupid, or rather, they allow this to happen to them. People who live in solitude manifest this defect less frequently than individuals in groups, and so it would seem that stupidity is perhaps less a psychological than a sociological problem. It becomes apparent that every strong upsurge of power, be it of a political or religious nature, infects a large part of humankind with stupidity, almost as if this is a sociological-psychological law where the power of the one needs the stupidity of the other. The process at work here is not that particular human capacities, such as intellect, suddenly fail. Instead, it seems that under the overwhelming impact of rising power, humans are deprived of their inner independence and, more or less consciously, give up an autonomous position. The fact that the stupid person is often stubborn must not blind us from the fact that he is not independent. In conversation with him, one virtually feels that one is dealing not at all with him as a person, but with slogans, catchwords, and the like that have taken possession of him. He is under a spell, blinded, misused, and is abused in his very being. Having thus become a mindless tool, the stupid person will also be capable of any evil, incapable of seeing that it is evil. Only an act of liberation, not instruction, can overcome stupidity. Here, we must come to terms with the fact that in most cases, a genuine internal liberation becomes possible only when external liberation has preceded it. Until then, we must abandon all attempts to convince the stupid person. Bonhoeffer died due to his involvement in a plot against Adolf Hitler at dawn on the 9th of April 1945 at Flossenbürg concentration camp, just 2 weeks before soldiers from the United States liberated the camp. Action springs not from thought, but from a readiness for responsibility. The ultimate test of a moral society is the kind of world that it leaves to its children, Bonhoeffer once said. For more information about Bonhoeffer, or to download this video without background music, go to sproutschools.com.
And if it is true that stupidity is not an intellectual defect but a moral one, well, there's hope. That's good news. As an intellectual defect, there's nothing that could be done. But as a moral defect, something can be done. But I agree with Bonhoeffer that trying to convince the stupid person to become moral is not the way to go. I mean, how often have we observed that in this attempt, quote-unquote, facts don't matter? That is why, at our show's opening today, I postulated that stupidity is a major piece of evidence that free will exists and that the ability to escape our stupidity is really the real marvel, power, and uniqueness of human beings. Human beings are malleable in the extreme, unlike animals. The fact that we are all born with an emotional and intellectual blank slate means that humans can be quote-unquote programmed to be so different from each other that there is no way for them to cooperate or even live at peace with one another, or the reverse, depending on how they're programmed. Not only are human beings malleable, they are also malleable. Two separate words, the word mal derived from the prefix of Latin origin through French, meaning bad, and implying usually imperfection or deficiency, and often simply a negative. Human beings are fully capable of being evil. Mal, bad, immoral, meaning anti-life and anti-survival, tyranny. Consider the horror of those children being taught to hate someone of a different race or religion or culture from birth. I can't imagine such a thing, and yet we're seeing it done. But the good news that also comes with that reality is that human beings are fully capable of being moral, meaning pro-life, pro-freedom, capitalism, individual rights, understanding that life is an end in itself. Which of those two polarities they end up aligning with depends entirely upon the programming of the human mind, which is done primarily with the use of language and through a process of learning the correct definitions and concepts that relate to reality. You've heard the phrase from the Bible, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." This refers not to the beginning of existence, I don't believe, but to the beginning of humans as rational beings, capable of conceptualization, the Word, with the ability to conceptualize and to create words and symbols to represent elements of reality around us, humanity ascended from the limited world of animals to an unlimited world of possibilities, not open to lesser life forms, those not capable of conceptualization. But not stupid. That status is reserved for humans alone. Thus, when Isabel Patterson cited the Marxist damage to language, quote, "Misuse of language is the means by which the Marxist cult of communism has done the most serious injury to intelligence," end quote, that was no overstatement. In her time, she argued that Marxist theory of class war was utter nonsense by its own definitions. It had no reference to either class or war if it related to capital and labor. It is physically impossible for labor and capital to engage in a war on each other. Capital is property, labor is men. Patterson argued that Marxist terminology reduces verbal expression to literal nonsense on the basis of fact and usage. And of course, she ridiculed Marxist thinking by talking in terms of the roundness of a triangle, which is a contradiction no different from the dictatorship of the proletariat. It has no meaning, she demonstrated. Now, one of today's most popularly misunderstood verbal nonsense, I think, comes with the phrase public-private partnership. The reality is that there's no such thing as a public-private partnership because there's no such thing as public ownership or public anything. This is the very non-existent concept that morphed into the absurd "own nothing and be happy" stupidity. Here again, Isabel Patterson wrote an entire essay demonstrating that public property is a fiction. But it's pretty easy to understand why, simply by applying the proper words and definitions to the term. To own something is to have the right to possess, trade, give away, or sell that which you own. If you are unable to do those things with regard to some property, good, or commodity, then you don't own it. As a member of the public, just try selling your share of some designated public property. You can't. You don't own it. All ownership is private. What is being called public property is really government-owned property, and in this context, the government is no different from a private individual except in one key respect. The government has an exclusive right to use force, whereas private individuals do not. And this makes any quote-unquote partnership between them an impossibility, since there's no level of equality and responsibility. Property is responsibility. And you may have noticed that the more quote-unquote public some property may happen to be, the less it is responsibly maintained. Just look at any of the major downtowns of most American and Canadian cities today. So look at it this way. Public education is government education. Public health care is government health care. And the reason both of these areas of services are so dysfunctional is because government is not capable of providing such services. The state is merely a means of confiscating the wealth of some and giving it to others, robbing Peter to pay Paul, or in other words, health care and education at the point of a gun. Just as Peter St. Ange commented earlier, it's remarkable how many people in the know have noted the sheer level of stupidity and ignorance to be found in the governments of Western nations. Martin Armstrong quite notably made a comment that of all the world leaders and politicians he met personally over his many years of consultation, only one, Margaret Thatcher, was ever even capable of understanding anything about economics or the principles he was trying to talk about. Our governments are filled with stupid people. That is why politically they find themselves on the left. Political maturity is a process of moving to the right. So how do we cure this stupidity? Well, just as Dietrich Bonhoeffer suggested, only an active external liberation, not instruction, can overcome stupidity. We must abandon attempts to convince the stupid person. Action springs not from thought, but from a readiness for moral responsibility. Now, in the end, that means both a cultural and political undertaking, one led by the true right, meaning freedom, capitalism, individual rights, not by the right wing. Now, I don't know if you've noticed or not, but almost every outspoken person in their particular field, whether in law, science, medicine, or politics, who is speaking to the truth, has been motivated by a sense of moral responsibility. I couldn't live with myself if I just remained quiet, is the variant of a phrase I've heard many a time since the war began in earnest, and we are in the middle of a war, one that will never be understood within the confines of the current discussion. So, on the return side of our upcoming bumper, from the Brownstone Institute, we'll be hearing the narrative of an essay published by Bruce Pardee on November 26, 2023, entitled The Elephant in the Room, Freedom and Virtue, Friends or Enemies. Bruce Pardee is Executive Director of Rights Probe and Professor of Law at Queen's University and has been a guest on our show in the past. When Robert Vaughn put me onto this link, he commented, quote, a wonderfully succinct explanation of the world of strange bedfellows we freedom people find ourselves in. Freedom people in an unholy alliance with virtuous authoritarians, end quote. But first, on this side of the bumper, from the 1980s brilliant British television series, Yes, Prime Minister, it would appear to be a fact that governments lying to their publics is nothing new.
I presume the Prime Minister's in favour of the scheme because it'll reduce unemployment.
Well, it'll look as if he's reducing unemployment.
Or look as if he's trying to reduce unemployment.
Whereas in reality, he's only trying to look as if he's trying to reduce unemployment.
Yes, because he's worried that it doesn't look as if he's trying to look as if he's trying to reduce. So how are you going to stop it?
Well, Arnold, the Prime Minister has somehow come to suspect that the plan may be the start of a leadership bid by the employment secretary.
How ridiculous. But the higher the office, the higher the level of paranoia.
Fortunately, yes. But paranoia needs something to feed on, and there's nothing like press leaks for paranoia fodder. Now, what if there should be a headline about this brilliantly imaginative plan of the employment secretary's being blocked by the Prime Minister?
Man overboard.
With any luck. But the trouble is, a cabinet secretary cannot be party to a leak.
No, of course not.
Whereas a former cabinet secretary, presumably as chairman of the Campaign for Freedom of Information, you have a duty to make certain facts available.
Are you suggesting that I give confidential information to the press?
Certainly not, Arnold. This is confidential disinformation.
That's different.
There's an elephant in the room, the speaker declared. He was right. I was at a gathering, as I often am, of people who aspire to rescue their countries from descending into woke, collectivist hell. but the attendees were not of one mind. Instead, there were two kinds of people in attendance. The elephant in the room was the tension between them. Across the West, virtue people and freedom people have been working together. At conferences, in think tanks, at school boards, on email lists, in living rooms, on X, and sometimes marching in the streets, they coalesce. These two groups constitute the rebel alliance against authoritarian woke globalism. But their political philosophies conflict. Virtue people believe that virtue is the most important thing. Tradition, faith, family, responsibility, dignity, patriotism, community, and spiritual or religious conviction are the pillars upon which the West must be built. Virtue people are often, but not always, people of faith, especially of the Christian variety. Laws, governments, and society, they believe, should promote the true, the beautiful, and the good. Freedom people don't share this view. They believe that freedom is the most important thing. Virtues, they believe, are for individuals to work out for themselves. The primary accomplishment of the West, they would say, is individual autonomy. The purpose of government is to secure individual rights to liberty. Freedom means the absence of coercion. You may decide your values, actions, and groups for yourself. Freedom means freedom from. Virtue people believe in freedom too, especially in this era of a liberal progressivism. But freedom means a different thing to them. Freedom is essential, they would say, but the decline of the West is due to an excessive emphasis on individuality. If that makes perfect sense to you, you may be a virtue person. If it sounds like a contradiction, you are probably a freedom person. Freedom, they would say, means the disciplining of desire, which requires limits. Freedom is the liberation to act responsibly, to be transcended, and to flourish virtuously. We become free, they would say, to the extent that our will becomes coherent with objective good. Freedom means freedom too. In the political sphere, these two kinds of freedom are incompatible. Freedom people expect their governments to keep the peace and protect the individual and otherwise to not interfere. Virtue people expect their governments to promote the good with laws and policies. Virtue people support laws that prohibit behavior that is, in their view, immoral, damaging to human flourishing, or inconsistent with common good. Assisted suicide, prostitution, divorce, pornography, even heresy, just to start, shall not be permitted. To achieve their ends, virtue people rely on force. At least, that's what freedom people would say. Virtue people use laws to achieve their ends, and laws depend on force. Every legal rule identifies a circumstance in which the state will bend the will of its citizens. Without the monopolistic violence of the state, laws cannot be enforced. Virtue people are willing to use that force to achieve their virtuous ends. Therefore, allege the freedom people, they are willing to use force to have their way. Freedom people are decadent. At least, that's what virtue people would say. If morality crimes do not exist and individuals are free to decide their own values, depravity ensues. Libertarians and libertines are cousins, virtue people would declare. Excessive individualism causes indulgence, narcissism, and social decay. But freedom people can be virtuous too. They can embrace faith, family, and community. They can disapprove of behavior, such as prostitution, that virtue people would ban. However, freedom people make a distinction that virtue people are unable or unwilling to make. Freedom people see two different questions where virtue people see only one. How should people behave? How must they behave? For freedom people, the first is philosophical and personal. The second is legal and coercive. The answer to the first does not answer the second. Freedom people do not impose their moral judgments on others. They will not have others impose upon them. Paradoxically, freedom people have faith that virtue people lack. They have faith in spontaneous order. If we leave people alone, they say, things will turn out fine. Individual decisions will coalesce into peace and prosperity. Virtue people do not believe in spontaneous order. They want their hands on the wheel so that they can manage people to virtuous ends. freedom people will not be managed. They believe that the West's problem is too little liberty. Virtue people believe that the problem is too much. Freedom people oppose the administrative state. Virtue people embrace it if it directs people to proper ends. Neither will sign on to the other's project. Although they cooperate to resist the tyranny of the woke, they are not likely to succeed unless they reconcile. At the gathering, most people were virtue people. The few freedom people present slowly realized that they had attended a kind of church to which they did not belong. The virtue people who filled the room, steadfast in their conviction that they knew best what is right and good, did not seem to be aware of them. Or, for that matter, that they existed at all. Near the end, I spoke with an earnest, soft-spoken gentleman in horn-rimmed glasses. In his ideal world, the law would prohibit behavior that conflicted with the good, as he perceived it. When I pointed out that some people in the room would oppose that enterprise with all their might, his mouth fell open and his eyes grew wide behind his thick lenses. That possibility had not occurred to him. Not everyone sees the elephant in the room.
And that analysis by Bruce Pardee goes a long way towards explaining why, as freedom people, we open our show with not right wing, just right. Broadly speaking, conservatives are perceived to be the right wing, which is just one of the two wings still attached to the same leftist political bird of fascism. But I'm not so sure that there's any real conflict between virtue people and freedom people, but again, that depends on your definition of each. In the context of Pardee's commentary, he's referring to a conservative religious Christian virtue, which is the key conflict with freedom on which his warning of the elephant in the room is based. In contrast, Ayn Rand described virtue this way, quote, "Value is that which one acts to gain and keep. Virtue is the action by which one gains and keeps it. Man has a single basic choice, to think or not, and that is the gauge of his virtue. Moral perfection is an unbreached rationality, not the degree of your intelligence, but the full and relentless use of your mind, not the extent of your knowledge, but the acceptance of reason as an absolute. My morality, the morality of reason, is contained in a single axiom, existence exists, and in a single choice, to live. The rest proceeds from these. To live, man must hold three things as the supreme and ruling values of his life, reason, purpose, and self-esteem. Reason as his only tool of knowledge, purpose as his choice of the happiness which that tool must proceed to achieve. Self-esteem as his inviolate certainty that his mind is competent to think and his person is worthy of happiness, which means worthy of living. Virtue is not an end in itself. Virtue is not its own reward or sacrificial fodder for the reward of evil. Life is the reward of virtue, and happiness is the goal and the reward of life," end quote. Now, I recall Ayn Rand once referring, for example, to pornography as quote-unquote unspeakably disgusting, but immediately made it clear that to censor it is even more so. And on the distinction between freedom from and freedom to, I've always looked at it this way. To the left, freedom means freedom from individual responsibility. To the right, freedom means having the right to be responsible. So you've got freedom from responsibility versus freedom to responsibility. But the fact is, and we've always known this, freedom and responsibility go hand in hand and are inseparable. I mean, how many times have we heard the claim that freedom is not a license to do as you please, which is an irony of ironies, in that licenses are granted by governments and authorities. Quote, "Freedom in a political context means freedom from government coercion. It does not mean freedom from the landlord or freedom from the employer or freedom from the laws of nature which do not provide men with automatic prosperity. It means freedom from the coercive power of the state and nothing else," end quote. And how ironic that this statement came from Ayn Rand's essay, Conservatism, an Obituary. Which brings us back to our theme of stupidity. Coming up next on this side of the bumper is a January 1st tweet that was titled Socialist Thinking in Real Time, in which a man is standing at the front door of his neighbor's house, speaking to that neighbor through an intercom system of some sort. Listening to this fellow state his argument for why his neighbor should provide him with free Wi-Fi at first makes him sound stupid, almost incapable of understanding the nature of Wi-Fi and how it works. But as he continues his plea for free Wi-Fi, it suddenly becomes apparent that just as Dietrich Bonhoeffer observed, we're not dealing with an intellectual defect, but with a moral one. And on the return side of our bumper, more stupidity in the form of an old, long disproven idea that is now being called game theory.
Hey.
I live next door. I've got problems with the Wi-Fi.
Okay, so why are you here to me?
Well, it's your Wi-Fi, isn't it? Have you done something?
Okay, but I've not got a problem with my Wi-Fi.
Well, I've got problems with your Wi-Fi. You've put a password on it.
What do you mean?
Look, how long have I been here now? I've been here 2 years. I've happily used the Wi-Fi, and now I see that you've put a password on it, and I can't use it. I think you're being unreasonable.
Sorry, what? Wait, what? What did you say?
Look, it's very simple. You have Wi-Fi, right?
Yeah, I've been, Wi-Fi,
right. Well, I've been happily using your Wi-Fi now for a couple of years, and all of a sudden you put a password on it, and I've got no access. I tell you what, you let me have your password, and that's the end of the problem.
Yeah, but hold a minute, you've been using my Wi-Fi.
Well, I don't know how much of your Wi-Fi it is. I mean, you know, it's a signal, isn't it, right? Well, the signal doesn't remain just within your four walls, so what comes out here is it's on public property, right? It's public. So I can use the signal.
But now you can't because I put a password on it.
Yeah, that's it. That's exactly right. So, look, there's two things we can do. One is, and I think the easiest thing is, let me have your password. Or, of course, you can always remove your password. I mean, it's just pretty easy, really. Simple as that.
And that would solve
the problem for both of us, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but the thing is, though, is, like, I'm paying for it. And, like, why... Yeah, but the thing is that, like, okay, so I put password in it. Yeah, I put password on it because my Wi-Fi was being really slow and my broadband suggested for me to put a password on it to make it faster. But obviously, because they thought other people were using it and coincidentally, someone else was using it.
No, I think that's very unreasonable. I mean,
my Wi-Fi was being slow because someone else was using it and coincidentally, it was you who's using it.
Well, it was probably me.
Yeah, we've established that. And then my Wi-Fi was being slower inside my house, so my broadband suggested I don't mind
how slow it runs, actually. You know,
I understand that. You don't mind how slow it runs, but I do.
Well, okay, but that's the Wi-Fi within your house. What about the Wi-Fi that's coming out the walls? And that's what I'm using. I don't mind how slow that runs. It's good enough for me.
Yeah, but like, what I'm trying to say is that Wi-Fi is still mine.
Well, okay, if you want to use some of it, I mean, you can sit in your garden and you can use the Wi-Fi there. I don't mind. But if you've got a lot of work to do, maybe you can let me know that you're using it so that, you know, it doesn't interfere with the downloading.
Yeah, I know, but I'm saying, like, right now I put a password on it, so then, like, now it's just mine.
Yeah, well, you can't, you know, I'm sorry, old fruit, but you're being unreasonable. It's not neighbourly. We're trying to be neighbourly about these things. So you keep your Wi-Fi within the house, lock the windows, close the door, seal up the letterbox, but anything that comes out through the walls is public.
But it's not public, though, is it?
Welcome back to the Mel Kay Show. It has been way too long since I had on my guest today. Thank you for joining me, Cynthia Chung.
Always a pleasure.
And today we're going to play a video, but I wanted you to kind of tell the audience what they're going to see.
Sure, which is titled Escaping Calypso's Island, A Journey Out of Our Green Delusion. And by the way, Calypso's Island is a reference to the Odyssey. And that's how the Odyssey starts, is with Ulysses trapped in Calypso's island cave of like a seeming paradise. And yet there really isn't a freedom within this seeming paradise. And he has to basically challenge himself after 7 years of being imprisoned by this nymph to make a journey out of the delusion that he's been stuck in. And what is it to have a purpose? What is the meaning of life? Is it really just to have this kind of, you know, sort of fake delusion of happiness? So we start with the discussion of, do we really live in a world where we have limited resources, scarcity? Is there really not enough food to go around? Is there really not enough energy to go around? Or if we do make enough energy for everyone, are we going to blow up the planet? You know, these kinds of questions. It's largely based off of the theory of game theory, which later on, The Limits to Growth, that was made, it was published by the Club of Rome. This has really shaped the entire system of thinking that we're in. And game theory, you know, people have to realize this is something that has told us that in order for someone to gain, another person has to lose. Thus, we can't have cooperation in the world. This is the justification that there's not enough to go around, so we will always have wars. And we challenge this, and we basically call bullshit on it. And I guess we're going to show a preview.
Our world appears to be captured within a cave of limited imagination when thinking about the future. Despite the incredible abundance which we could create, the only acceptable discussions about the future of humanity showcase a belief that scarcity, war, and poverty are the only future which we should expect. In this episode of our series, we will evaluate the principled fallacies of this belief in scarcity, limited resources, and overpopulation. We will do so by exposing several pseudoscientific beliefs that are currently holding humanity back from an age of freedom, creativity, and cooperation. It is common in our modern day and age to hear the phrase zero sum, that we live in a world that is governed by limited resources, and that for one group to gain a bigger piece of the so-called pie, there must in turn be another group that loses a piece of the pie. This scenario is often referred to as a game, that is, that we live in a zero-sum game where the players must weigh the costs and benefits in operating within such a framework. This theory of zero-sum first originated with the advent of game theory, the mathematical theory of games of strategy, developed by John von Neumann according to his book, Theory of Games and Economic Behavior, which he co-authored with Oscar Morgenstern. The crux of game theory is that an individual's behavior will always be motivated towards achieving an optimal outcome, which is determined by selfish self-interest. That for one player to maximize their payoff, it must come at the cost of the other players.
We have to prepare for a more angry world.
Today, much of the world is governed by this very theory. We are now at a point where it is considered by many to be essential, if not at the very core of what dictates and models our economic, political, sociological, as well as military behaviors and outcomes, and is taught as such in many prestigious universities as something pretty much set in stone. This approach to understanding systems began in the early 1970s as the Club of Rome popularized the notion that the entire world, which included all resources, population, farmland, and pollution, could be measured using linear computer models. These models, which all assumed that we lived in a zero-sum world, would be used to extrapolate trends into the future, paying no consideration to humanity's ability to problem-solve via technological innovation.
It's not some science fantasy effect from 2001. This electronic display emanating from Australia's largest computer is a picture of the condition, past, present, and future of planet Earth. The condition of the planet starts to become highly critical, and if we don't do anything about it, this is what's going to happen. The quality of life is going to go right back to practically zero.
But can we be certain that we do live in a zero-sum world governed by limited resources and selfish self-interests? Is this truly all that we are left with at the end of the day of what decides the political and economic policies that will affect the welfare of billions of lives on this planet? After all, it is acknowledged by the theorists themselves that the entire functioning of their mathematical model relies upon the assumption that we are governed by selfishness, and that they feel confident about this assumption since reality has apparently confirmed this fact to them. But what if humanity's nature were shaped by something else entirely? And what if the resources contained in our environment were not as limited as von Neumann supposed?
I have to confess that at first I wasn't sure if Cynthia Chung was saying game theory or gain theory, but I guess it doesn't really matter when the theory is so stupid to begin with. And as far as the unneighborly neighbor who feels entitled to free Wi-Fi at his neighbor's expense goes, accusing his neighbor of being unneighborly was really a projection of his own actions in this regard. And his theory of public property even transcended the stupidity of our already established fiction of public property. He argued that his Wi-Fi problem would be solved if only his neighbor would do one of two things: give him his password or remove his password. Did you notice the one thing he didn't suggest? He could have offered to pay for half of his neighbor's Wi-Fi expense, but of course, public property and neighborliness were not his objectives. He just wanted something for nothing. I guess that could have been called another version of a public-private partnership. Or maybe another version of a zero-sum game. He pays zero and his neighbor pays the sum. You know, everything about socialism and its infinite array of collectivist variants is stupid to the core. This is why it appeals to the average politician. After all, much of politics could be called organized stupidity backed by the use of force. The zero-sum idea that in order for one person to gain, another has to lose, is an idea that is only valid where force and coercion are concerned. It's just a way of describing theft or robbery. The robber gains, the victim loses. And that's exactly what the zero-sum game is trying to justify. It's also why the zero-sum game is evidence of zero intelligence and a lot of stupidity. In decades long past, this stupid idea was simply called the fixed pie theory, which I think is a better label, since baking a pie is a simple act of production to envisage. And I think that at the root of all such half-baked ideas is some element of crony politics, also purposely and incorrectly labeled crony capitalism, since crony capitalism is another contradiction in terms, since cronyism and capitalism are exact opposite concepts. Where consent and voluntary exchange are concerned, as is the case with capitalism, every economic transaction is a win-win game. Otherwise, the transaction would simply not occur. In any voluntary exchange, each side participates on the premise that what is being gained is greater than the price being paid. For example, if I buy a newspaper for a dollar, that means I value the newspaper more than the particular dollar, and the vendor who sells me the newspaper values my dollar more than the newspaper he's selling me. You can apply this simple principle to any voluntary exchange or relationship. It's always a win-win situation, including your voluntary decision to join us again next week, when we will continue our journey in the right direction. And until then, be right, stay right, do right, act right, think right, and be right back here. We'll see you then.
Fade into color, and color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
You know, I've given Lisa everything she ever wanted. What can I do?
Well, you're gonna have to tell her how you feel, Coach.
I can no longer hold my tongue. Oh. Want me to do it? Coach, come here. I'm a daughter myself, right? Let me tell you something about my father. My father is a very wise and learned man, but he never gave himself a chance to really get to know the boys I brought home. He would decide that he didn't like them for no better reason than one of them had bad posture or another one had facial hair. I'll never forget the night when I was foolish enough to bring home a utopian socialist.
Oh,
oh no.
Unbelievable. I know, it was unbelievable. I was a rebel then.